The following program is titled, The City Club of Eugene, Better Health at Lower Cost. What's a Community to Do? The Social Determinants of Our Health. It was recorded on March 10th and features guest speaker Dr. Joshus Freeman.
Please help me welcome Dr. Freeman.
Well, thank you all for being here and for inviting me. I hope it's we've had a little technical difficulties, but I think we're in great shape now. So I am Josh Freeman, and I will try to talk, not forever, but it will be close, and I'll leave a little time at least for people to tell me what I was wrong about. So I want to just start out with an outline of the talk, if I can figure out how to make this. Is all right. So we'll talk about, I'll address a little bit what the concept of social justice is, which you may be familiar with. What are the social determinants of health and how both impact upon health and health care? And then try to end up a little bit with what communities can do to help improve the social determinants of health. The term social determinants of health comes from John Rawls, although obviously the concept has been around for hundreds, if not thousands of years, often used in faith communities. And Rawls said in his book, Theory of Justice, in 1971, we'll have a lot of 1971s here, all social primary goods, liberty and opportunity, income and wealth, and the bases of self-respect are to be distributed equally unless an unequal distribution of any or all of these goods is to the advantage of the least favored. Well, it does say equally, but it also implies least favored, or it says least favored, which implies things aren't completely equal. And no matter how equally you try to distribute things, some people are going to need more. They're going to have physical or mental or age-related issues that require them to have more services than others. But it's pretty expensive. Another expert, not so much a philosopher like Rawls, although people might disagree, was this guy. And this is inscribed on the FDR Memorial in Washington, D.C., and says, the test of our progress is not whether we add more to the abundance of those who have much. It is whether we provide enough for those who have too little. This makes a different claim. It doesn't say equally. It says enough. It says that our social institutions, our society, you can read government, should not be in the business of trying to figure out how it can add to the wealth of the wealthy, but at least meet the needs of those who don't have enough. So the question I have is, do we have a system of social justice, as either Rawls or Roosevelt put it, in the U.S.? And I would, no? I agree. I think we have a system in which the most privileged exert great influence, unsurprisingly, but sometimes mostly seem to use it to increase their privilege. In medicine, we have a field, medical ethics, and we have four core principles of medical ethics. They're beneficence, which means do good things for people. Non-maleficence, which means don't do bad things to people. Autonomy, which means people should have say in what is done to them. And the other one, which people always forget when they're trying to list the four principles of medical ethics, but it's justice. And I would sort of conflate justice with equity in healthcare. The idea that everyone, regardless of their station, their insurance status, their wealth, their race, should have the opportunity to access appropriate care. And with their autonomy, they should be able to choose from all the options that might be appropriate and not be limited because of who they are. A further extension is no one should be able to access inappropriate care. As long as we're quoting people, I thought I'd introduce, if you don't know him, Rudolf Virchow, the father of social medicine. Dr. Virchow is well known among physicians because his name is on lots of things, Virchow's node, Virchow's autopsy. But when he was a young physician, the government of Prussia sent him in 1848, to investigate an outbreak of typhus in Upper Silesia, a part of Prussia that was a coal mining region. And Virchow's report on the typhus epidemic in Upper Silesia, it's down there, is what earned him the title of Father of Social Medicine, because he said the reason that people have typhus in this area is because of the conditions in which they live. Their poor housing, the cold, inadequate food, exposure to coal dust, exposure to environmental toxins, and it was the social setting that led them to have typhus. We know that typhus is caused by a germ, and the germ is carried by fleas, and those fleas live on rats, and so we can do that ad infinitum, but the question is why you would be in a social setting where you'd be exposed to rats and the fleas who live on them and the germs that they carry. So Virchow said, the physicians are the national advocates of the poor. Sometimes attorneys is how it's translated. That's a mistranslation of avocat. And social problems fall to a large extent within their jurisdiction. He said that medicine has led us into the social sector. More recently, also in 1971, over 100 years after Virchow, Julian Tudor Hart, a physician in the coal mining village, coal mining again, in Glencorrig in Wales, published an article. He's a family doctor and also an epidemiologist, and he did a lot of research and gathered a lot of data and was able to prove to the satisfaction of the editors of The Lancet, the main British medical journal, that the availability of healthcare services is inversely proportional to the need for them. That may not be true in Eugene. I don't know. But it's true in every place that I've worked. The more you have, the more services you get. And in general, as we'll see, the less you need them because the healthier you are, on average. Sometime earlier in the 1960s, Dr. Michael Marmot, now Sir Michael Marmot, conducted a series of studies with his colleagues in England looking at the relationship of social class and mortality. To control for the fact that sometimes poor people have riskier jobs, they work outside, you know, that might affect their mortality rates. Trees fall on them if they're loggers. He studied people who worked in Whitehall, the British seat of government, and found a linear relationship between life expectancy and social class. The people at the top live longer than the people in the middle, who live longer than the people at the bottom. In the 1980s, they began the Whitehall II studies, which began to look at why that might be true. Okay, we found out it's true. What is it that mediates that? And the theories that have come out of Whitehall II and have been continued to be examined are those related to stress, basically sort of neurohormonal, that stress creates the secretion of hormones which affect your body, cause wear and tear, and make you die sooner. So what are the social determinants of health? Well, among others, there are access to jobs, access to housing, access to food, access to warmth when it's cold outside, education, transportation, so you can get where you need to go, whether it's to the doctor or to work, or as we'll find out later, to a park so you can walk, and also the treatment and particularly education of women. The data actually shows that the single factor which is most correlated with economic success in a nation is the level of education of women. It's not surprising. I mean, at minimum, if you don't educate half of your population, you're going to limit your economic viability. But it also says something about the society when it doesn't believe in educating women. Cameron Jones is a physician, PhD, MPH, who currently is the president of the American Public Health Association. And she works at Morehouse. She used to be at the CDC. And I've been using her social, her analogy, cliff analogy, for looking at the social determinants of health for a long time when I give talks to first-year medical students, because it illustrates really, I think, you'll judge for yourselves. Well, I'm not going to go through the whole, kind of cartoon slideshow, but basically it says, if it illustrates the idea of health as being something on top of the cliff, and if you fall off the cliff and get banged up, then you're sick. And we could bring an ambulance over, that's our current medical care system, pick you up from the bottom of the cliff and maybe try to repair you. But maybe we could do something else. Maybe we could put a safety net up there so if you fell off the cliff, you would not get hurt so badly. And that would be safety net clinics or safety net hospitals. But maybe more sensible is to put a fence at the top of the cliff so you don't fall off in the first place. And that's called primary prevention. That would be immunizations, checking your blood pressure, making sure that you've had your screening test, making sure that those silent killers that you may not be hurting from are not slowly eroding your health. And all of that along the cliff face is the current medical model. We can do all of those things. We can do prevention, we can put up safety nets, and we can finally bring up the ambulance and take you away if you really get hurt. But the social determinants of health refer to how far you live from the edge of the cliff. And some people live closer than others. And if you live close enough, and if there's no fence, then a strong gust of wind could blow you over. And the metaphor is that if you're just getting by, if at the best of times, with nothing going wrong, with no challenges, you're just getting by, you're just paying the rent, you're just feeding your family, you're just able to keep the heat on, then it doesn't take much in the way of illness or something else to blow you over the edge. So as much as I'm supportive of PNHP and single-payer healthcare and healthcare for all Oregon, all that does, that's important, it's necessary, but it doesn't address that some people live closer to the edge of the cliff than others. And what we're going to ask you to do is to think about how members of the community might help to address that. Dr. Jones also talks about what she calls the social determinants of equity, because people will say, Dr. Jones, the social determinants of health are real and they're important. You've just illustrated them to us, but it's really not about race. You talk about race also. It's about socioeconomic status. It's about class, right? And she says, right, it's about class, and it also raises the question of why are there so many black people in the lower class? And that's about race, and that's about racism. So how does this play out in the health of the people in our communities? I'd like to tell you a few stories. You can read them, I'll read them. People say, don't read your slides. I'll read my slides because I get to tell the stories. This is a story called Dead Man Walking. You may be familiar with the name from the movie with Sean Penn and Susan Sarandon about Sister Helen Prejean. Some of these other people, Stillman and Taylor, took the name and used it in an article that they published in the New England Journal of Medicine a couple of years ago. And it starts out saying, we met Tommy Davis in our hospital's clinic for indigent persons in March 2013. He and his wife had been chronically uninsured despite working full-time jobs, and we're now facing disastrous consequences. The week before this appointment, Mr. Davis had come to our emergency department with abdominal pain and obstipation, bad constipation. His examination, laboratory tests, and CT scan had cost him $10,000, which was his entire life savings. At the end of the evening, he'd been sent home with the diagnosis of metastatic colon cancer. Mr. Davis had had an inkling that something was awry, but he'd been unable to pay for an evaluation. If we'd found it sooner, he contended, it would have made a difference. But now I'm just a dead man walking. It's not a one-off situation. I've talked about this to doctors in many settings as recently as yesterday to a bunch of residents nearby. And they came up and said, I had a guy just like that. You know, yesterday or last week. In the same year, the New York Times published an article about a barbecue waitress in Houston named Donna Atkins, who had learned that she had throat cancer from her ENT surgeon. She didn't have insurance and had waited for over a year of having a sore throat before she sought care. The doctor told her she needed to get a special image of her neck and it would cost $2,300, which was more than she made in a month. I didn't even have the money to walk in the door of that office, Ms. Atkins said. In 1994, Physicians for a National Health Program published its proposal for a quality healthcare system. And in the article, they discussed quality. I'm not going to talk about single payer here, but I'm going to talk about another quote from that article, which says that the gravest of all quality defects is denial of care. A lot of times we'll hear people talk about the great quality, you're a great doctor, great surgeon, great hospital, but if the denominator is just the people we took care of and not the people we didn't take care of, it doesn't mean much. You know, if half of you are, of all the people on this side of the room are sick and we do great care for the three of you, leaves the rest of you out. A meaningful denominator needs to look at the population, at all the people in your community who needed care, and say how many of them got the care that they need. So the conflict is between what we can do and what we could do. And what we can do is lots of stuff. We have great technology, very skilled doctors, top-notch hospitals, fantastic imaging procedures, but not everyone can access these. And sometimes people get too much. I don't have it in here, but a friend of mine who's the chair of family medicine at the University of Alberta in Edmonton now, but for most of his career worked in Michigan, which is in the United States, and has experience in both systems, says, in the U.S., we don't provide the health care that people need, you know, that you need. We provide the health care that someone can make a profit giving you. And if they can make a lot of profit giving you, because you have good insurance and good money, you might get a lot of it, including a bunch of things you didn't need. So my question is, what should Tommy Davis have done? What should Donna Atkins do? What should we tell them? What can we do for them? And it's a problem, as I mentioned, that I face every day. So I just, I looked one week when I was attending on our inpatient service at University of Kansas Hospital. I looked at how many of the people I was taking care of had what I would call essentially a diagnosis. The primary condition was they were poor. I mean, they had other things, but the main reason they were in the hospital was they were poor. I've abbreviated for this audience, but I'll just tell you about two. I changed the names. So AG had diabetes and high blood pressure, and he lost his job and was uninsured and didn't go to the doctor for quite a while. But he was lucky. He didn't have much problems with this, except for this small sore on the bottom of his foot. And then he got really lucky and got a job, which was a pretty good job. In a few months, he was going to get health insurance. But it was a night watchman job, and he had to walk all over the place, and he walked 20 miles a night, which was probably good aerobic exercise, but not so good for the foot ulcer. So when I saw him, he was in the hospital with a severe infection requiring IV antibiotics and was looking at a possible amputation. P.S. had diabetes also, and he got a severe infection, which is not uncommon, and he required also IV antibiotics and intravenous antibiotics, and he also needed, was so bad, he needed to have surgery to take out the pus, and the pus continued to drain from the open wound. So we have a machine called the wound vac that you can attach that sort of sucks up the pus. But it needs to be replaced every few days. And you should be happy to know that if you need this, you can get home health to provide it, as long as you have health insurance and a home. But he didn't have either one, and it made follow-up more difficult. And this is where I give the commercial for my hospital, and I say, and they kept him in the hospital for 6 weeks, getting IV antibiotics at their cost. It is true. Not every hospital would do that, and I'm not sure my hospital would do it for every patient, but I'm a pain in the neck. So what are health disparities? The social determinants of health manifest in disparities before people even access health care. And I think that many of them are better called inequities, the ones that we could change. So at this point, we can't make people younger. Older people have more health problems than younger people. And so there's a disparity, meaning a difference, between the health status of older people on average and younger people. I would call that an inequity because I don't know how to fix that. But disparities, differences that exist based on socioeconomic status, based on race, based on income, based on where you live, are potentially remediable, and in my opinion should be. And those are therefore inequities. So some places have done better than others. You've done better in Oregon than we have in Kansas. Maybe my patients would have like been fine if they'd been in Oregon, if they'd been in Eugene, where we've expanded Medicaid, where they might have had insurance and be able to access. I don't know what it would have done for the House, but that's something we'll talk about later. You remember that Dr. Tudor Hart said the availability of health services is inversely proportional to the need for them. Well, people with more resources have more availability, and they may have, on average, less need for them. Often, we use education as a sort of exchange for socioeconomic status. And this looks at the percentage of people at different education levels who said that their health was fair or poor, as opposed to good or excellent. People with less than a high school education, over 25% said their health was fair or poor, whereas among college graduates, it was less than 6%. So there's a total relationship between education level and perception of your health. And by the way, perception of your health is a pretty good way of describing actually your health. People have pretty good perceptions. And now we have changes in our own society. Just last month or 2 months ago, Kaysen Deaton, who were economists at Princeton, published an article in which they demonstrated that, well, actually, they weren't looking at this when they did their study. They were economists, but they found it. They found that unlike every other group in every other country and every other developed country, the mortality rates among white Americans is going up. And that's really remarkable. I mean, I don't know when this last happened, that people started getting higher mortality as the world progressed. Maybe at the onset of the Industrial Revolution, when people moved from rural areas to smog-filled cities. I'm not sure. But you know, the other thing is it wasn't evenly distributed among all white people. It was poor people. And it wasn't really new. People from Virginia Commonwealth had reported it in a paper a year and a half before. And the trend has been coming for a long time now, just recently being recognized. The causes of increased death that they found were suicide and drug abuse. And that's the study. And then they postulated causes. They didn't do focus groups to find out why. But the postulate is people get hopeless. That you're middle-aged, you're older, you've lost your job, you've tried to find a new job. You can't find a new job. They're taking away your house because you can't pay your mortgage or pay your rent. By the way, you're in chronic pain, maybe because of your old job, because lower income people often work with their bodies. And so your doctor has prescribed you, if you have a doctor, has prescribed you opiates, and you take them a lot because you're in pain a lot, and now you're addicted to opiates, and everything isn't very good, and maybe you end up committing suicide. And the last thing I'd say here is, yes, it's only white mortality rates that are going up, but they're still lower than African-American mortality rates. So they're going up. African mortality rates are going down, but there's still a big gap. Here's the graph. On the left, you have men. On the right, you have women. It's a little hard to see, but the different lines on each side are deciles of income. So the top line is the top 10% of people in income. The bottom line is the bottom 10% of people in income. And you can see the slope of those lines. Well, I need to, the x-axis says year of birth. So this first point over here is people born in 1920, and this last one is people born in 1950, and what their life expectancy would be at the age of 50, which controls for infant mortality. They can sometimes skew life expectancy. And back in, when the people who were born in 1920 were 50, in 1970, they could expect to live about 78 years. And the people born in 1950, in 2000, could expect to live 85 years if they were in the top decile of income. And as you can see, not only did the slopes get less, but the difference between the poorest and wealthiest people was not so much. And now, or for the more younger people, it's much bigger. So we have a situation where the gap, and you can see for the lowest decile of income, there's hardly been any change. The people born in 1950 are as likely to live as long as their parents, whereas for the more well-to-do people, they're going to live a lot longer. And then this is women. This is the really shocking slide. For the lower 30% of women, they're going to live less than their parents. White women are going to live, who were born in 1950, have a shorter life expectancy than their parents and their mothers if they're in the lower 30% of income. I don't know when that's ever happened. If you want to know a little bit more about comparisons, the Virginia Commonwealth University has a county health calculator you can look up. It's called countyhealthcalculator.org. And it displays, lets you compare states or counties within states. So you could compare Oregon to Kansas, or you could compare Lane County to Benton County, or whatever you wanted to do. And it measures two things: education, measured as percentage of people with at least some college, and income, which is measured as percentage of people with at least twice the poverty level of income. It tells you how you do and compared to the best and worst county in your state, or the best or worst state in the nation. It has a cool little slider that lets you move up and down and say, if we had a higher level of people who had, you know, more than 20, than twice poverty, how much could we improve people's health? And they measure that in mortality rate, cases of diabetes, and cost for caring for diabetes. So Oregon actually is really good. It's near the top in education. 63% of people have some college. It's pretty high in income. 67% of people earn twice the poverty level, although the average in the U.S. is 68. These are just numbers, but almost 13,000 deaths a year in Oregon, almost 200,000 people with diabetes, and a cost of almost $1 billion in caring for them. But based on this data, if 5% more people had a higher education level and 4% higher income level, we could save 1,300 lives, prevent over 11,000 cases of diabetes, and eliminate almost $55 million in costs. Now, I'm not silly. I don't mean that we'll give you some community college courses and now all of a sudden you're not sick anymore. It's just an indicator of health risks and the social determinants of health. Here's a map. You can look at the best and worst on this graph or on the map. Here I put some of the counties in your I-5 corridor with the greatest population, and you can see that they all do pretty well with some college and higher levels of income. So then that brings us to the question, okay, Oregon's doing better than Kansas. Maybe one county is doing better than another. Even in Eugene, you haven't solved all the problems. So what can we do? Well, one thing has to do with social services. Bradley and Taylor published a book and then an article in the New York Times saying, you know, everybody says, Freeman says that we spend a lot more money on healthcare than other countries. And that's true. We are number one in the world in how much we spend per capita. It's about $9,000 per capita. Number two is about $6,000. And the average for developed countries is between a third and a half of what we spend per capita. But Bradley and Taylor say those other countries spend more on social services. And if you add them together, healthcare plus social services, the gap narrows. It doesn't go away. We still spend more. But what really makes us an outlier there is almost all of that spending in the United States is on medical care. And in other countries, they spend it on those social determinants of health, trying to see that people have houses, that people have enough to eat, that people have an education that they can pay for. So what can we do? Well, I'm a doctor. What can we do as health providers? Well, we can try not to discriminate against people. Hopefully not many of us do that on purpose. We can try to provide the same options for everyone, no matter who they are. We can not make assumptions and say, oh, this person is probably irresponsible, doesn't take care of themselves, won't do their treatment because of the way they look. And amazingly enough, It seems to correlate with how much they look like me. People who look like me couldn't be really all bad. But people who look like them are irresponsible, untrustworthy, probably won't be compliant with treatment. We also can provide new and expanded services based not upon how much profit we can make from it, but how much the community needs them. We can ask you to contribute money to our hospital, not so we can build a new cancer center to take care of people who are already being taken care of perfectly well across town at somebody else's cancer center, but maybe to provide cancer care to those people who don't have enough money to pay for it. Providers do respond to financial incentives, but who pays for it? And how do we decide that? Then the next question is, what can communities do? Well, address the social determinants of health. How you do that, I can't tell you how to do that in Eugene, Oregon. But you can look around your community, and I suspect many of you have, and see what the needs are, and try to figure out how we can help that. You can support government and private programs that work to benefit the least advantaged. I'll bet you I'll do that. And you can provide equity in philanthropy, which I'm going to talk about a little bit more in a minute. Some of you may have heard of the harm reduction model. The principle of harm reduction is anything that decreases the probability of harm to somebody or to other people is good. It's been mostly talked about in this country in regard to HIV/AIDS and things like needle exchange programs. So, yeah, maybe we don't like the fact that they're shooting heroin, but at least if they're shooting heroin with clean needles and they don't share them because we provide them to them, they're less likely to transmit AIDS. And if we provided them with free drugs, they wouldn't have to hit you on the head to steal your money. So that is decreased harm to you. So that's the model that's been used. But basically, it says, here's where you are, and here's where we want people to be. We want to move them along that path. But if we put a 12-foot wall in the middle, it's going to be hard for them. And we do that all the time. We say, you need to stop drinking before we're going to try to find you a place to live. It's not so easy when that's all you have to keep you warm when you're lying under a bridge. The harm reduction model says we want to get from here to here, but the path is rocky and there are twists and turns, and sometimes you're even going backwards. When you hike through the mountains, that's what happens. But eventually, you get where you're going if you're headed along the right path. And we encourage people to do that. So one of the key things that a lot of communities have done in Oregon, in Colorado, in Houston, in New Orleans, is housing first. It says, if we could eliminate homelessness, it puts people on that road to improving things. That it's a lot easier to think about going and applying for a job. It's a lot easier to feel like you can go to AA meetings and give up your drinking if you have a place to live. And some of these places, Houston and New Orleans, have virtually eliminated homelessness. You can't completely, because somebody wasn't homeless yesterday, they're homeless today, but pretty much gotten rid of it. They said, this is a priority. And then we help people to move on. In Oregon, a study just came out in January, that's not long ago, showing that formerly homeless people had overall lower health care expenditures after moving into supportive housing. A lot lower, $8,700 lower than the first year. I used to think about this when I was a resident at Cook County Hospital in Chicago. You know, we would get bums admitted to the hospital with disease, and sometimes they had lice. I didn't see anybody with typhus, but could have happened. And so we'd come in, we'd bathe them, and then they'd burn their clothes. happened once in a while. And we'd be ready to discharge somebody and say, well, we can't discharge him because he doesn't have any clothes. So we'd have to have the social services people go down to Goodwill or somewhere and or some bin that they had and get clothes. But what I reflected on is the 2 days that it took, the cost of the hospitalization, we could have sent a telegram to a tailor on Savile Row, had him hand make a suit and ship it over, and would have cost less than keeping the person in the hospital. We're really, really silly about this stuff. So housing seems to be one thing that we can work on as a community, get people places to live. It's not to get them off the streets because we don't like seeing them on the streets. It's to get them into a place where they can hopefully have an opportunity to move on with their lives. So I like to tell the story of sidewalks. I live in Kansas City, Kansas, and we have a division in my Department of Family Medicine that does research, but it's mostly all community-based research in collaboration with people in the community and organizations in the community. And we went to a neighborhood, happens to be called the Argentine, and we asked them about what we could do to help them, and they said, oh, we need sidewalks. You know, there's a lot of places where there's no sidewalks. You could get hit by a car or the sidewalks are broken up. And we said, yeah, right, but we do health. So let's talk about health. And they said, well, we need food. We have no supermarkets near here. And if you don't have a car, it could take 3 hours on the bus to get to the closest supermarket. And that makes it very hard on families. And so we tried to figure out what we could do. We had less ambitious goals than they did. We thought maybe we could get people who did have vans to drive people, you know, maybe we could get carts that would sell things. But we actually were successful. They were successful. I say we only in the humblest sense, in getting a supermarket to move into the neighborhood. And that was great. Everybody was really happy. And then people said, well, how am I going to get there? Because there's no sidewalks. And I have to pull a cart to be able to carry my groceries back. And the sidewalks, when they're there, are all broken up, or else I have to wheel them down the street and we could get hit by a car. Well, we couldn't do very much for sidewalks in our medical school, but people could. And they talked to their city councilmen, and they talked to their state legislatures, and they got them to prioritize fixing the sidewalks in this community. And it happens to be a community at the bottom of a hill. We have hills in Kansas City, Kansas, because it's bluffs along the river, steep hills. And on one side of the street, there's a wall, a retaining wall holding up the hill. And it hasn't been fixed in a long time, and the sidewalks are all buckling. So the people who live on that side of the street can't really walk down the sidewalks. So they start to get out and try to help fix those sidewalks, at least patch some of the holes. And the people on the other side of the street came out to help them. And that's what's called social capital. That's what's called a community. And that's what people can do together. And then we started talking to people about, now that you have food, you need to exercise. And you don't need to go to a gym. You don't need to lift weights. You don't need to have an elliptical trainer. Just go walk. And somebody said to us, well, how can I walk? How can I exercise? I don't have a car. Well, that's sort of funny. But she meant it, because it was a dangerous neighborhood. And besides, if she was going to walk, she had to walk where there were no sidewalks or down the middle of the street. She could get hit. She had neighbor friends and other people who exercised. They took their cars and they drove to a park. Or they drove to the mall where they could walk. But she couldn't walk because she didn't have a car. It's just something that you don't know what you don't know. You can't always envision what you don't know. But if you try and ask people, you can learn things. One of my partners had a patient that would get admitted to the hospital at least once a month for a long period of time. And she always came in with the same, she had heart failure. And she would always come in swollen up with legs that were this big. And we would give her a little IV Lasix, that's the diuretic that takes the fluid off. and she would lose 20 pounds in the first day or two. And we would say, Mrs. Jones, her name wasn't Mrs. Jones, do you take your oral Lasix at home? And she would say, of course. And so we couldn't figure it out, but we would send her home, and 2 or 3 weeks later, she'd be back in the hospital. And finally, my partner, who was her doctor, went to her house. And he found out she had a hospital bed, which he knew because he had ordered the hospital bed. But what he didn't know was there was no way the narrow hallway in her house and the turn into the bedroom was going to allow them to get the hospital bed into the bedroom. So it wasn't in the bedroom. It was in the living room, which is where she spent time. And she also had a couple of teenage grandchildren who lived with her. And they had their friends over and they'd watch TV in the living room. And there was no way that she was going to be running down the hall to the bathroom or using a bedpan in front of her grandchildren and their friends. So she really wasn't taking her Lasix. Now, it's pretty obvious when I tell you the story what the problem was, but I didn't think of that as a possibility. And her doctor didn't think of that as a possibility. And it took somebody actually going out to her house to find out. And she didn't tell him that that's what was wrong, because it was embarrassing to her. Her doctor, my partner, is a really good guy. He went out to the hardware store, put up a curtain that separated her bed from the rest of the living room. She didn't get admitted to the hospital again for the next 8 months. It was an easy solution, but a solution that you can't come to if you don't know what the problem is. Dr. Marmot, who I talked about before, was elected president of the British Medical Association in 2011. He was surprised that a guy like him would get elected president of the British Medical Association, but he said, I might as well run with it. And he pushed the association to focus on the social determinants of health. They put together a white paper, which is available online, looking at things that affect health in the social sector, and looked at principles for how one might address the social determinants of health, went a step farther and said, what is the evidence, after all, we're scientists, for the effectiveness of interventions? Because I can tell you stories, you can go, they're great stories, and they get your attention. But really what we want to know is what works, not what seems like it makes sense. This is the hard part about talking to people, is what makes sense, what seems like it should be true, is what we call a research question. Because something that didn't seem like it made sense seems stupid to research. But until you actually do the study and find out, you don't know if it actually works. So what they did was make a list of best practices. Find out that in this town, they were addressing this problem in this way, and it was working. In another town, they were addressing another problem another way, and it was working. And if you had a problem in your town, you could look through a searchable database and find out who was doing something that worked and try to do the same thing, or maybe call them up and find out how they'd put it together. It's really about what doctors, because this was the medical association, but in collaboration with their communities, can do to help people. In the U.S., we've done some things. You might have seen Atul Gawande's article in the New Yorker a few years ago called Hotspotters, where he talks about people like Jeff Brenner in Camden who said, let's use things like geographical mapping to find out where the people who are costing us the most money live. And what they found out in Camden was two places. One was a public housing project and one was a senior citizens home. And the people in those two addresses accounted for 40% of all the health expenditures in Camden. Now they had some information and they could go try to address it. They put a clinic in the public housing project. They sent people around to the homes of people in that project and in the senior citizen building to find out what people's problems were. What were they eating? Where were they able? How were they able to get around? And the community could begin, even in a very impoverished community like Camden, New Jersey, to identify things relatively low cost that would address some of those barriers. I don't know if anybody put up any curtain rods between the bed and the TV set in the middle of the living room, but it didn't cost my partner very much money. And things like that can make a real difference, but you have to know what they are. So many places have tried to emulate them. In Kansas City, we have a group called CCO, Communities Creating Opportunities. It's a faith-based group primarily, but you don't have to be faith-motivated to work with them. And they try to identify problems in different communities in Kansas. In Oregon, you have your CCOs. So you know more about this probably than I do. And I've learned a lot about them since I've been here for a few days. Some of them are for-profit, some of them are not-for-profit, but their goal is to just slow the rate of increase in health spending, not even bring it down. And they figured if they can slow the rate of increase from 5.4 to 3.4% per year, so it still goes up 3.5% a year, Oregon could save $8.6 billion in 10 years. So it's been pretty successful. They've seen some improvements in the areas, in particular where they pay bonuses to doctors. Unsurprisingly and sadly, the things that they don't pay bonuses for don't get done. It's an unfortunate characteristic of many people that what you're measuring and rewarding me for is what I do, and I let the other things slide. But there have been some big achievements. They discovered that they went from 0.1% to 7.3% of primary care visits had screening, brief intervention, and treatment for alcohol and substance abuse. And we don't want it to be 100%, at least not intervention, because not everybody has an alcohol or a substance abuse problem. But as I have been saying, on and on, you don't know if you don't ask. And you certainly don't know if you say, well, they look like me. They probably don't have a problem. You've all probably read this quote from former Governor Kitzhaber about which would cost more money, treating somebody for heat stroke and dehydration in an emergency room or buying them an air conditioner. And that's the kind of thing we need to think about, because the cost of providing medical care when people are really sick is much greater than preventing conditions, except usually we don't think of buying people air conditioners as a medical intervention. Your health insurance doesn't pay for it. They'll pay for your hospitalization once you have the heat stroke, if you have insurance, but they won't buy you the air conditioner, and yet it does make sense. So I said I'd talk about equity and philanthropy. It's nice to give away money if you have it. It's nice if you're a foundation, you can give away money. And my request is that people consider how will the project that I'm donating to improve the health of the most vulnerable people, or all the people? Or will it just create more options for the non-underserved, the served? And I gave you the example of the cancer center. Maybe it's not a problem in Eugene, but it's a problem in Kansas. It's an issue. It's a thing. I'll say, in Kansas City, where we want you to give your tax-deductible donations to my hospital so we can build a fancy new cancer center with fancy new equipment so that he comes to see us instead of the hospital across town, which had a perfectly good cancer center. Because if he goes to the hospital across town, he may get better, but we don't make any money. I'm not against competition. I'm not even against profit, but there's a mechanism through which you should be able to raise money to build your new cancer center, and that's called venture capital, if it's about making you more money. If it's about trying to improve the health of the community, maybe we need to see if we can raise money to pay for the care of people who don't have health insurance, give them our great cancer care. Or maybe we need to build a hospital with beds to take care of people with low profit diseases, like schizophrenia or other psychiatric conditions. You know, we can be the wrong people in medical care. We can be poor, we can be uninsured, and nobody wants to take care of us. Nobody wants to provide care for us. But we also can have the wrong diseases. So most cancer is a bunch of different diseases, but a lot of it is very bad. But it also happens to be really profitable to treat. schizophrenia is really bad, and it isn't at all profitable to treat. And there's no coincidence in the fact that we have many more places and options to treat one. So I think that the symphony is great. Arts make a big difference in a community. I love to go to the opera and the ballet, and I'm really glad that there are rich people who give a lot of money to support them so that I can go, even for ridiculous amounts per ticket. But I wish that they would sometimes think about how else they might make a difference in their communities. And especially when they're taking their money and trying to make a difference, because they're giving it to the hospital, right? I mean, the biggest recipient of philanthropy in my community is the Children's Hospital, because sick kids, nobody likes sick kids. They got more money than God. I mean, everybody likes sick kids. Nobody wants kids to be sick. Let me be clear on that. A little bit more judgment about what the impact of your donations or your organization's donations or your foundation's donations would be. And not, you know, maybe there's another alternative to giving money to the Boys and Girls Clubs. Or maybe that's the best investment for the health of your community. I don't know that, but do the research and try to find out what it is. And maybe there are some things that are better. The private sector, you and the members of your community need to think about how they give their money and not just say, well, I gave it to the hospital. Isn't that good? We talk about the benefit to the community rather than the benefit to the institution. And remember that institutions, even not-for-profit hospitals, even not-for-profit organizations that do good work are often more very, very concerned, often for good reason, with their own survival. So social justice and health. We improve social justice and we improve people's health through equitable distribution of resources. Not equal, but equitable, based on the need that people have. Addressing the social determinants of health so people live farther from the cliff and have a little bit more resilience. Maybe they have a house to live in and now they can try to deal with their drug addiction. We recognize systematic and systemic injustice, like, gee, the buses don't go very much in this neighborhood. The houses are falling apart. There are no sidewalks. And besides, it's next to an old battery factory and there's lead in the soil. We advocate for positive change in the healthcare system and society. We teach our students in Night Uncle School and anywhere else, nursing school, and for all I concern, third grade, about structural violence. And we learn how social issues can lead to poor health. Health in all policies means we require people to provide jobs in the community that people can get to, or at least transportation to be able to get to their jobs. We say, how do we use land? What's our built environment like? I don't know Oregon that well. I know Kansas, and Kansas is full of small towns where downtown is dead. And there's a high school and a Walmart 3 miles outside of town you have to drive to, built on cheap land. Why couldn't the high school be downtown where the kids could walk? I mean, these are small towns. We're not talking very far distances. Well, we tried that. About 10 years ago, very sadly, a town in western Kansas, Greensburg, Kansas, was essentially destroyed by a tornado. A town of 1,500 people wiped out. And so in rebuilding it, we tried some of those things. Put the new city hall and the new high school at opposite ends of downtown, of Main Street, so people could walk to them. Thought about how we could put in parks so people can exercise, even if they don't have a car. And tried to design a built environment in the community that encouraged healthful behaviors. Our tax structures, our housing, we talked about a lot, how we do our agriculture, and where we put housing and where we put environmental pollutants are all issues of health and all. So in summary, I'd say that social conditions, not healthcare and not medical care, are the biggest determinants of health status. Social inequities, which we can think of as lack of social justice, results in health disparities. Addressing inequities decreases the burden of disparities and ill health. And communities, if possible, in collaboration with physicians and other health providers, can and should be involved in efforts to address disparities and advocate for social justice in order to improve their health. And so I'll end with a couple of quotations. This one from Martin Luther King says, "Philanthropy is commendable, but it must not cause the philanthropist to overlook the circumstances of economic injustice which made philanthropy necessary." It's profound. It's important. It's also kind of a long sentence. So I sometimes go to this more pithy one from Jonathan Kozol: "Charity isn't a good substitute for justice." I'd end with a quote from Dr. King: "Of all the forms of inequality, injustice in healthcare is the most shocking and inhumane." That's my book. I thought I'd get to plug it since I came here. But I can go past it. And I'd be happy to take any questions if I can try to answer them, or comments or criticisms or anything that you have to say. We have a microphone, or people can talk and we can look. Thank you.
Insurance.
Yeah. Well, somebody knows.
Too late. Okay.
I mean, there are a lot. You could start with social services agencies that take care of those people and try to help them. There are lots of them, I'm sure, in Lane County. There's a Lane County Health Department that probably has data on that. All hospitals, to maintain their not-for-profit status, have to do studies of their communities and the needs in the community. So, if the hospitals aren't sharing it with you, ask them. I hopefully won't take a Freedom of Information Act. communities have to do community benefit studies, and they find out things like who's uninsured, how many poor people there are, you know, what their needs are. So it isn't actually that hard to find out. And I'm sure in Oregon, where there's you could start with your CCOs and ask them. Why don't you give away the microphone? I don't have to call on people then. It takes the pressure off of me.
So, did you have a
Are you finding that people are now beginning to apply these concepts of changing the social structure rather than just doing this top-down catastrophic health care plan? Are we seeing a trend in this new direction?
I think so. It's not a huge trend. And it's always been true that some people in communities did this work. But I think that there's more awareness of it. I think that I'm not going to take a political position here, but we can look at the current election cycle and see that a lot of people are really unhappy. And whether they're looking at Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders, they are really unhappy, and they say the current system is screwing us. I tell the story because on Saturday I went to caucus in Kansas. So this is, you know, just recent, and it was a Democrat. I'll reveal this. I went to the Democratic caucus, and there were people caucusing for Sanders and Clinton, and each of those had somebody who spoke for them. And the person who spoke for Sanders, I'm going to try to get through this, was a young man, and I have to say, saying that he was a young man means he was on the Sanders side, because there weren't any young people. I mean, my particular caucus area went 3-1 for Sanders. The state went 2-1 for Sanders. I'm not bragging, but it just happened. So he was a young man, and he got up there and said, "I have two daughters who are 2 and 4 years old, but I want to talk about Christine, my older daughter. Because when she was 1.5 years, she developed acute myelogenous leukemia. And she almost died. And she almost died. I blame myself because we didn't take her to the doctor, even though we knew she was sick. We kept hoping she'd get better because we were terrified about what it would cost us if we took care of her. We brought her in. But she didn't get better. And finally we brought her in and we found out she had leukemia. And after many months, she became eligible for Medicaid. That might be better in Oregon than in Kansas. But she got eligible for Medicaid and she's being treated now and we hope she gets better. But I don't think anybody else should have to go through that and not bring their child to the doctor when they're sick because they're afraid they're going to go broke. I'm not telling you that Bernie Sanders is going to fix this. I'm telling you that this person was making his political decisions based on his perception of what our society needed to change to help him and his family and his neighbors. And I have some hope.
Charlotte asked the question about, you know, is the trend changing? And I can tell you right now, in my therapist office, when I talk with my clients, the first thing I do is get permission to work with their doctors, and I send their doctors notes, and the doctors are shocked and write back to me. And, you know, it's been easy to get things for, it feels really awesome to write to a doctor and say, this client needs this, 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 and this, and then she or he would be much more compliant with what you want. And it's just, you know, it's just us so simple about relationships and communication, but that has not been part of our system. You're not supposed to talk to doctors, you know, unless you have some kind of a, I mean, doctors are, I'm sorry, sir, but finally coming down to the approachable, because this, they're recognizing the system isn't working either and are willing to, many of them, go right out on the edge to make it work.
Well, I'm really glad that that's your experience, that, that doctors are working more with you and with others. That's good news. I hope it's happening in my town and across the country.
I think there are two illustrations I know of the inequality. One is Michael Moore's latest film about invasion. I forget what the
Should we invade
is.
Next? Yeah.
But anyway.
We invade next?
It's a terrific movie, and it really points out the difference between other countries in the world that have health care and our country that doesn't. And I just had a program about mental health care and what a difference it makes in our community to have some assistance. And they said of the very steep epidemic we have now of heroin, maybe because we're on I-5, had probably a good reason for it, but it's how people are just so down about not the right job, being overworked if they do have a job, and the complete system now of inequality that's really hit a large percentage of our people. I think it's very shocking.
It's very bad. I wish I could be shocked by it. I'm not shocked anymore, but it's not good.
In the our present system, as here in Oregon and in Lane County, with as we call it, Obamacare, and more people having access, that our medical or our support community helping these people are not adequate. We need more doctors, particularly general practitioners or family doctors, and not the specialists, and more support of the social workers, the people that go in the home and look at the environment that a person is living in. And do you see that we are starting to work toward having that broader access of people that are this whole family gathering around the people that need services?
Well, there's a lot of talking about it. And there is some trends in that direction. You and everybody else needs more primary care doctors. That's my job, is to train primary care doctors. I guess part of my job is also to try to convince medical students that they should want to become primary care doctors. And then they say, but I have $200,000 in debt, which, by the way, as you know from compound interest, doesn't mean they put away $20,000 a year for 10 years. It means they're going to be paying $4,000 a month for 20 years. And I can't afford to be a primary care doctor because I can make twice as much, three times as much, five times as much as a specialist in a different field. And yet, primary care doctors, not just in Lane County and not just in Oregon, but all across the country, are the number one doctor in demand. So economics 101, I don't know if any of you remember Father Guido Sarducci from Saturday Night Live, the 5-Minute University, one sentence, you know, is all you remember from whatever class you took. Well, economics was supply and demand. You know, I'm going to teach you that. You remember supply and demand. It's all you're going to remember from economics anyway. Well, that isn't supply and demand. There's some movement of supply and demand. Primary care doctors are now getting higher salaries than they used to. Makes it hard for me to recruit doctors on my faculty because they can make a lot more money working. The people graduating from residency can now make a lot more money than the people who've been teaching for 20 years. But they still can't make as much as they could in a bunch of other specialties, some of which have the added advantage of having better hours, working shifts, not taking call. We call those specialties the high income to work ratio specialties. Now, if it's your kid and you love them and you want them to have a good life and you want them to come home and see your grandchildren, it's not such a bad idea for them to have a high income to work specialty. Unfortunately, it doesn't serve the society. So I don't know why supply and demand hasn't kicked in yet. I think there's a lot of obstacles to supply and demand in the medical field, but I think there is movements toward this. We need a lot more doctors. We need a lot more healthcare providers. We need a lot more people who can communicate and work with social workers, therapists, nurses. And my story about my partner who went and visited that lady in her house is somebody has to go to people's houses. Doesn't have to be the doctor. Doesn't even have to be the visiting nurse. But it has to be somebody who goes and says, my God, her bed is in the living room. Or goodness, you know, you're complaining that he didn't come into his appointments, but his front steps are so rotten, he probably would have fallen and broken his hip if he'd tried. Or there's six people there using one toothbrush. Or you thought you knew what, we did medicine reconciliation when they were admitted to the hospital last time. The pharmacist looked at the list on the computer and I said, are you taking this one? Yeah, you're taking that one? No. You know, but there's 10 drawers and medicine cabinets full of bottles that they don't know what they are, what they're taking. I think we're making progress, but there's big obstacles. And part of the incremental progress from the Affordable Care Act is, we've guaranteed the profits of insurance companies. We could have used that money for something else, paying primary care doctors more, hiring community health workers, you know, helping people get housing. And the only thing one of the things you could be very happy about in Kansas is I'm paying for your Medicaid expansion. I had heard an economist talk last week, or 2 weeks ago, I'm losing track. And I learned that not expanding Medicaid in places like my state not only was inhumane and bad for people's health, but it made no economic sense because it's a massive transfer of my tax dollars that I pay to the federal government to you to expand Medicaid. So you're welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Freeman. You had a lot to say tonight. I'm going to buy your book if you have copies for sale, by the way.
I don't have it. I didn't bring books, but you can get it on Amazon. It's, I think, $19. I haven't seen a dollar of it yet. So it's fine with me if you buy it for $2.99 on your Kindle, except I can't autograph it.
Okay. Well, thank you. We're working right now. You mentioned a little bit about Housing First, and you talked about the tremendous savings in medical care from the one individual who saved, I think you said, $8,400 over the course of
8,700, something like that.
Over a short period of time. And we recognize that, and we're moving from a rapid rehousing model, spending more of our money moving toward Housing First, but it's not very popular. You know, it's not very glitzy, and people don't really appreciate the fact that we're putting addicts in houses, and
especially near them.
Most especially near them, absolutely. But it's a direction that we're going as a county right now, and we just got a $2.4 million grant. But my question for you is, in your experience, are you seeing it gathering momentum throughout the nation? I'm anecdotally hearing about it, and Utah has a pretty strong model that we're looking a little bit at. But Utah has a lot of faith community intervention that we're not going to really get here in this state. So, you know, moving toward Housing First and away from rapid rehousing, putting people who are going to benefit the greatest and the most for the long haul on housing. So, you know, I'm really interested in hearing about what you've seen that's happening elsewhere. Does your book cover that a little bit? And I just need to find the right arguments to get the vast majority of the people to say, yes, that's a good idea. I don't think anybody in this room disagrees with me.
So I think it's happening in some places. I mean, it's a little bit like that model for Britain. We can look at what are they doing in Houston? And what are they doing in New Orleans? And what are they doing in Colorado? And what are they doing in Oregon? Because we're not doing it in Kansas.
I can tell you what we're doing in Oregon, and there's not very much. You know, Portland has a project, the Bud Clark Center, that has a little bit of true Housing First. You know, the wet bed housing that is active users are being housed, and you know, housing active users isn't a very popular thing, but it is the best way, in my opinion, the best way we can spend our housing dollars.
So, I don't have a good answer. I would wait for you to write me with the answer. It's not in my book. This Housing First thing has come out since I wrote the book. You worry when you write a nonfiction book that by the time it comes out, it's going to be outdated. Luckily, most of it isn't. We still have problems with the social determinants of health and with profit in health care and with lack of primary care and a lot of other things that I write about. But housing, I didn't. I guess I'll say, I've done a few talks this week, and I've had some questions that seemed like hard, and one of the things I've tried to resist is getting into philosophical debates with people about what would be the, do these people deserve health care if they, you know, shoot drugs or drink or don't take care of themselves or, you know, don't exercise or eat crappy food? And you could get into like a long argument that gets nobody anywhere. So my question is, so what do you think we should do? To anybody, what do you think we should do? Okay, this is a bad person. You know, he's a bum. He doesn't take care of himself. So should we let him die in the street? You know, wait till he comes to the emergency room. What's your solution? Well, I'm willing to consider that one, you know.
Give us 1 year. We'll have one chapter.
Well, thank you. If there's ever a second edition, you can write the chapter.
So as a comment that relates to part of your story, I fully support the performing arts. I'm involved with it. And it's a significant part of the fabric of the community. But the major contributors to the performing arts are their specialty practices in this area. So the money flows from the patients or the insurance companies clearly in excess of what it needs to, and then it flows through them to the arts. Would you like to comment on that?
It is.
I don't think it needs a comment.
We do have a faith community here that is very interested in housing, and we've done all we can do, but maybe we need to get together with you to really do something. This equity business is huge, in certainly in my denomination here, statewide, and we're getting together on that issue, and we can all work together. I think the problem is we all know what we need to do, but we need to get together to do it. The blessed community, we need to work together, and we can do that. I'm convinced we can.
I can sit down.
I was going to thank you as well for your talk and talk a little bit about Housing First. I spoke recently to the local CCO here, and when I mentioned Housing First, I remember someone raised their hand and said, "You mean you would let them drink in their apartment?" And I said,
"Well, let you drink in your apartment."
That's what I said. I remember laughing and saying, "Well, I know if someone told me I couldn't have a glass of wine in my apartment, I might be homeless too." But we are, as a housing community, working on the Housing First model, and we are also working with our local CCO. Where I work, we're providing healthcare workers in affordable housing community centers, and they're going in people's homes, and they're buying air conditioners, and they're hanging up sheets. The problem is we're working where people are already housed in low-income housing communities. The problem is we just don't have enough housing here. So I think that's what we're working on, and I know that that's what Mr. Farr is talking about back here. But I just wanted to thank you for your talk and tell you, I think...
Thank you for your work, all of you.
I think...
If you talk to each other, that would be a great outcome.
Yeah.
Josh, could you comment a little bit on what people might do? You commented on some, but I think you mentioned about working with legislators. But I also wanted to raise the possibility for people here, before you answer, something called community benefit, that hospitals, especially nonprofit hospitals, collect and are obligated to give back to the community to maintain their nonprofit status. And I don't know if Peace Health is a nonprofit hospital. Okay. So there's community benefit money, especially in the past 2 years since Medicaid has paid very well. In Good Samaritan Hospital, an extra $17 million came in 2014. So this is money that in the past they would say, well, we're giving $17 million in community benefit because we didn't get paid this amount. Well, now they have that much. How are they using it? How's Peace Health using their community benefit money? Do you know? Can you find out? So there's a challenge for you. And then you mentioned legislators and... Okay. Well, I heard him say, and I've heard it before too, that your legislators rarely get letters. Surprising. How many on the average do you think each legislator gets?
What?
How many on the average does a legislator get? What? How many letters?
I think the number's 10 or something. I mean, depends on the letters. So I do not know the answer to that one.
Well, nobody, but if you, let's say there was an issue that might be a benefit to the community and not so good for somebody with money. And somebody with money goes over and says, here's a big check for your campaign if you oppose this bill. And you haven't written to your legislator. They'll probably take it and vote against the bill. But if 30 of you in this room had written, that's going to be a lot more letters than they got. I can tell you, at least for a state legislator, that's going to be overwhelming messages. And that's the legislator goes, I'd love to take your money for my campaign, but my mail is 10-1 in favor of this bill, and I want to get reelected. You'd be surprised. I mean, well, go ahead and Tell them, prove me wrong.
So I wanted to respond just a little bit to your community benefit question somewhat. In Oregon, there's essentially no requirement for a nonprofit hospital to provide any community benefit to do an analysis of the benefit of the community. The only there's a little bit of a requirement to provide some sort of report. And that's it, period. And there's a little bit of other requirements from the Affordable Care Act for what a community hospital is. That's one of the things that we are going to be approaching, we as in HCEO and perhaps other groups, in the 2017 session and say, you should look at what legislation might be useful because many other, or a number of other states actually have some specific requirements. And Oregon maybe should do something more on that. So, Illinois has some specific requirements. California has a little bit. Washington has some. And I forget, I could look it up fairly easily. I have that information.
The New Jersey court just converted a nonprofit hospital to profit because they said they're not providing any nonprofit benefits to the community. So it wound up in the courts.
One of the things you can talk to your hospital about is, and they say, well, there's no margin, no mission. Do you ever hear that?
Yes.
Well, okay, now you have your margin. What's your mission? You know, and if your mission is just to further increase your margin, then all you are is a profit-making hospital that doesn't pay taxes.
Yeah.
And so that was a right decision. A better decision would be for them to have a mission that had something to do with improving the health of the most vulnerable in the community.
So something I heard a couple of minutes ago reminded me of a quote I often think of by a guy named Ron Edmonds in 1974 about education. He said something like, "We know more than we actually need to know to improve the educational outcomes for every child in this country. What we lack is the commitment to use it." And it strikes me that there's no lack of knowledge on how to solve the housing problem, beginning with abundant evidence that housing first is an answer. So it's not what sort of puzzles me about education and now about health is, what does it take to persuade people to make the commitment to use the information we have to make a difference? That why are they so attached? I mean, how can we pry their fingers loose from a little bit more of the cash that they're reserving and allocated for the common good? But it's not like we don't need one more chapter on the evidence. We got millions bits of evidence. What we need is a willingness to use the evidence to do what needs to be done.
I just want to make an appeal for everybody here who isn't already a member of Healthcare for All Oregon to become a member. How many are already active? So some are. And do whatever you can. If it's speaking, if it's tabling, if it's hosting a house party where you bring people in to watch a movie, which you have copies of. There's one that compares Stockholm to Seattle. There's another more recent one that looks at healthcare from the standpoint of a business owner, a large manufacturer in Pennsylvania, and why he feels that his business suffers because of our healthcare system and how much better it would be under a single payer. These are movies that we can show. In fact, you're going to show it here pretty soon. It's called Fix It. So spread the word to come see it. And when is it going to be?
May.
Yeah. The other is that it takes money to keep a movement going. And so I'm jumping in here and asking you, if you haven't already contributed to Healthcare for All Oregon, please do it. There's one paid person, and there'll be another two soon to keep this motion going. and building a movement for passing a single-payer bill by 2000. You're the expert on this.
By 2020 is our goal. We will have it on the ballot in 2020. That's the current goal. So just to go back to the hospital community benefit, there's another state that has an interesting requirement, Maine, and this requirement is for both for-profit and nonprofit hospitals in Maine. They have to provide free care to any Maine resident up to 150% of poverty level. So that's what one state did. Oregon could do something similar if we thought that was the best use of a community benefit, but we could also make it broader and say, you know, you guys go out and the hospital can analyze what's best, and we have to say, not only do you analyze it, but we got to look at it and see if we agree. Yeah.
That's important.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. So anyway, there are some things of that nature that could be done. It may turn out that the hospital isn't the best place to house these community benefits. The CCOs already have a requirement to do some of this too. That may be a better place to house it. So there's a lot of things that can be done in Oregon with our current model with just a little bit of tweaking, and we should be looking at those.
Thanks for listening to the City Club of Eugene, Better Health at Lower Cost, What's a Community to Do? The Social Determinants of Our Health. The complete archives of previous City Club programs are available at klcc.org.